Hi, I'm Renelle Golden, and you're listening to the Movie Making Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Atlas VPN. Hello, everybody. Today we are here with Kevin Longa. He is a filmmaker and he has done it all, exploring the world and also probably eaten almost every type of food there is on this planet. How are you doing today, Kevin?
I'm doing fantastic. I've barely eaten today.
Oh, you were just waiting, right?
Yes.
I'm excited to talk to you because you're doing something different. What makes it different is the purpose to what you're doing. And I would love to hear about, first of all, your journey to becoming a filmmaker, and then we'll get into talking about your new show, Taste. So how did you end up being a filmmaker?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I've always been enamored with films and filmmaking. I grew up watching movies. Like, I had my own personal Blockbuster video.
Oh, wow.
Like, all of my savings and all my allowance and all my, like, you know, gardening work or tutoring or whatever I did to earn money would go straight to buying DVDs at the local Best Buy on Tuesday. I would, like,
oh my God,
ravishly, like, you know, in the newspaper, you get like those little ads for newspaper ads. I would just go straight to the Best Buy section where the DVDs that were coming out on sale, and I would buy the one like that came
out. They used to have like the $5 DVD, like the specials.
Exactly.
And I think Walmart did that too. You can get these like dirt cheap, but they're good movies. They're just like a little older. So,
exactly. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And the bargain bin at Blockbuster itself and everything.
Yes.
Before, that went away. But
how many did you end up with? Do you know? Did you end up with hundreds? Were you that bad?
Absolutely, hundreds. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Really? That's my son in video games. Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
He's an adult, though. It wasn't when he was a kid.
Wow. That's quite a lot of video games. I feel impressed. For me, yeah, like it was probably over 500, between 500 and 700.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I always really loved watching movies and was always a really great escape, especially since I was a very shy kid. Mm-hmm. And I was also a bit overweight and kind of feeling, and also I know this is a podcast, but I'm kind of ethnically ambiguous.
My kids are too. They're multicultural. I don't even know how you put that. Mixed race.
Yeah. I'm mixed race, and sounds like your kids are as well. And
they are.
I feel like it's afforded me a lot of privileges being mixed race. But when I was a child, I did feel kind of like I was not, you know, Asian enough for the Asian kids, not white enough for the white kids, not black enough for the black kids. So, like, but it helped me become that kind of chameleon. And movies was a way to kind of like understand the world and understand how people live in it and to have identity. I mean, at the core of every film, every story, whether it's actually cinema or the theater or just writing.
Right.
I feel like it's the author or the director or whoever is asking the question, who am I? Who are you as a human being? And so it was kind of like my way to understand what it was to fit into the society as a person who wasn't really a person who kind of fit in.
Find your identity. Because
exactly.
You were many things. Yeah. My kids are Asian. Their dad is from India.
Oh, so really?
They were unique. Kind of a unique mix, and we had interesting experiences when they were young. And then they've grown up and they just kind of mesh with whatever at this point.
I bet they are treated like a local in many places in the world. I certainly have been.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't travel that much because, you know, we just didn't. I don't know why. I always wonder, when was the first time you got to go travel? Were you a kid or?
Yeah. My family is not especially wealthy, but we like to spend money on travel when we can.
That's nice. I like that.
Yeah. And so my first experience was in Paris, France, and London. China.
China.
I'm Chinese.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
How old were you?
Chinese. I was 9 years old.
You were a little guy. Okay. Oh, that's cool.
This was before, you know, China really opened itself up to the world, before like the 2008 Olympic Games.
Yeah.
When Beijing was, there were more bicycles than there were cars.
Yeah. Do you think it's changed?
Oh, absolutely. It's just, I mean, there's certain parts that certainly hasn't. And it's not like I've traveled extensively throughout the country recently, but I was back in Beijing during when I was filming Taste with Asia a few years back. And it was like,
different.
Yeah, it felt like I was in the Jetsons or something like that. Like the monorail that went from the airport to the city center, that was never there when I arrived to Beijing. And that also kind of informed, like, I have four loves in life. I love films, food, travel, and entrepreneurship.
Oh,
and that kind of blends. Into what I do now. I do an international food documentary short film series that feature undiscovered food entrepreneurs from around the world. You asked me about my beginning. So basically I started making films ever since I was 8 years old. I made everything from motion Lego movies to dramas, to skate videos, music videos.
How did you do it? What were you using?
I was using my dad's Hi-8 video camera. The thing
we used to
film our birthday parties and stuff like that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then eventually I graduated to a mini DV camera. The digital DSLR revolution.
Yeah.
And mirrorless cameras and things like that. But yeah, it started with that humble little Hi-8.
That's so cool. Did you make your family watch every movie you made?
Oh, absolutely. I made my family participate. I have a video of I really love Steven Spielberg.
Right.
I mean, what young kid doesn't, especially Jurassic Park came out.
That's better.
Yeah. And I just, I was enamored with that story. And so basically, I have a small little video. It's actually on my Instagram. A movie of me directing my mom and my dad as I made my first film. It was my first film.
That's so cute. I'm gonna have to go watch. I love that.
It is actually kind of cute. My mom, I sucker her into running away from a T-Rex, and she's like, how did I get hooked into this?
more drama. Scared. Run faster.
Yes. I literally say, run faster. She's I'm too old.
Oh my God. I love it.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That was the beginnings of my directorial debut.
Awesome. That's a great origin story or whatever you call that. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Pretty funny. All right. So fast forward. You get out of high school, you know this is what you're going to do for a career.
Mm-hmm. There's a little bit in between
school
that informs kind of why I do food documentaries.
Okay.
So as I mentioned, I was fairly overweight, and I ate some pretty bad food back in the day. I would inhale a half a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts in one sitting.
Oh, wow. Are you from Florida? It started in Tampa, where I went to high school.
Well, actually, Florida did play a huge role in my filmmaking career. So I was very enamored with Disney as well. And our first, I can't remember whether it was China or it was Disney World. That was our first family trip. China was our first abroad trip.
Okay.
But Disney World came, I was in third grade. And I was doing a lot of animation and things like that at the time. And Florida, I ate a lot of Mickey Mouse pizzas.
Florida food, yeah.
No, I'm from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. That's still kind of, there's magic in California somewhere.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the home of Pixar, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I went to school in LA. I went to college down in Los Angeles, but I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is the northern part of.
Right.
And it has a very different vibe than SoCal.
Yeah.
I was not doing well in the health department, and I was getting kind of picked on sometimes for my roommate, and being picked last for kickball and all that kind of stuff. And in fact, so I remember this one moment. It was after one kickball match, and we had these kind of like bikes that anyone could use to ride home, and someone. Oh. Kevin, don't let Kevin take a bike. He'll pop the tires. And that just like shot through my plump little chest and like up my throat.
Oh God.
I quivered and started to cry. And I went back home, and the next nail in the coffin was I saw a brochure. Both my parents are eye doctors, and they work at, for their entire lives, they worked at Kaiser Permanente as
often. Oh, wow. Okay.
And
I know eye doctors well.
What's that? Sorry?
I know eye doctors very well.
Oh, I'm sure.
I've had many. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And actually, they like to say that they like seeing people like you, people who have partial blindness and are able to use your skills for your impediments towards something like filmmaking.
It was my eye doctor that changed my life, not to change the subject. And I promise I'll listen when you talk. But I had a performing arts academy, and I woke up one day and big chunk of my vision was gone. And I ended up with like 7 different neurologists, every kind of doctor you can think of. I can't tell you how many spinal taps and trying to figure out what's wrong. And, you know, the one doctor was my regular neurologist was like, you probably have something that's going to be fatal because you waited too long or whatever. I prepared the kids. They were little. Mom's might not be here much longer, blah, blah, blah. And after a while, I got tired of being poked and prodded, and I was losing my vision. It went to where I was legally blind, not, you know, total darkness. But I refused to go to the doctors anymore. And that enabled me to actually find a world-renowned specialist that was an eye doctor without all the little parts of the story. I went to see him, and the first day that I went to see him, I was so fragile by that point. I was like crying all the time because, you know, no one was helping me. And he changed my life because he said to me something, and I was like, damn, I got to snap out of it. He said to me that blindness, going blind, it's not a death sentence. You can still live a full life and have dreams and blah, blah, blah. And the way he said it, that was 13, almost 14 years ago, changed my life because I stopped feeling sorry for myself. I started realizing there's still a life to live and, you know, so much to do. And because of my daughter, I ended up becoming a screenwriter after I lost my eyesight. Before that, I was a mom and I was into music and all that kind of stuff. And going blind made me go into film and entertainment, which you would never have thought that's where somebody with vision issues would end up. So that's my weird story, but it saved my life.
That's not really cool. And it's very related to my story with health as well.
Filmmaking.
So like,
so what did the brochure say?
Well, it said what to do when in big bold letters, what to do when your child's obese. I don't think they did it on purpose. Like they just forgot it was there. And, similar to your story, I was in the hospital like a week later, and nurse. So for you, it was an eye doctor who changed your life. For me, it was a nurse.
Oh, wow.
And she came walking in. In her hand, she had this clipboard, and with her other hand, she like lowered this like these horn-rimmed glasses from like the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Aww.
She kind of looked like that slug in Monsters, Inc.
The one that talks with them. Yeah, okay.
And she looked down at the chart, and she kind of like gave me a piercing glare and looked over the brim of her glasses and said, Kevin, if you keep this up, you're going to get type 2 diabetes. And I just froze. And I had this kind of like epiphany moment. A lot of my family members, including, for example, my grandparents who took me to China and London and Paris and South Africa, they had diabetes. Yeah. I remember giving my grandfather blood sugar tests and picking his finger. And like my cousins have type 1 diabetes and they had to give themselves insulin shots. And, you know, every kid hates needles, including myself. And so that just mortified me. I didn't want to give myself those shots for the rest of my life. And so literally the day after that, I put myself through like a personal boot camp until like Krispy Kreme grease and butter and sweat was seeping out of my pores. And
you just said, that's it. I'm changing my life.
Yeah. Wow. I went cold turkey on fast food. I haven't touched McDonald's since. My normal meal at McDonald's before that day was large fries, large Coke, a McFlurry, two cheeseburgers and McChicken.
Like at one go?
Yeah, in one go. And this was when I was 11 years old. So, you know, that was a lot.
You were a hearty eater.
I was a hearty eater. And people called me Husky. People called me Twinkie.
Wow. You know, How long did it take you to make an impact on your health once you decided, all right, I'm doing this?
It took some time. Thankfully, you know, time was on my side because I was 11 and I'm very grateful. Like, I think that's one of the greatest gifts that I've gotten as.
But to be 11 and do that on your own, I mean, that's like powerful stuff.
It was accumulation of many of those things. Like it was all those little pivotal moments that I mentioned before, but also my English teacher at the time, he assigned us to go see a documentary for extra credit called Supersize Me.
Oh my God. I was going to guess that. Okay. Wow.
And that's how I got into documentaries. And to kind of close this loop, you were asking about after high school. Well, right before, in junior year of high school, I made my first feature length food documentary called Fueling America. It was about food corporations and how they affect American.
Wow.
Food. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Probably 16, 17. Yeah. Junior year.
Did you get people to like talk to you? And
oh yeah. Yeah. I had executives from like Pizza Hut.
You're kind of amazing. Oh my God. Wow. I had
Dole, the banana and fruit company. Yeah. People like in my hometown, there's a Pez museum. So I got a guy from the Pez museum.
Oh, that's funny.
Local farmers. And what was very advantageous I feel very lucky was that, you know, I lived in the Bay Area. And so I was able to film and interview farmers and people who were revolutionizing the organic and regenerative farm movement before it was even popular.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing that you did that as a kid. Oh my gosh. That sort of sealed the deal. This is what you're doing with your life, didn't it?
Well, not quite.
Oh no. Wait.
I mean, it all ends up great in the end, but like, you know, I was a pretty studious kid and I still am infinitely curious about the world. And, you know, when you're 16, 17, 18, and you're just out of high school and you're going to college, like it's tough to know exactly what you want, especially.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I think that's fine. Like, there's that Baz Luhrmann quote in that song. Some of the most interesting people the guy knows is like 50 and they don't know what to do with the rest of their lives. And to ask a high schooler or even a college student, like right out of graduating college to know exactly what they want to do.
It's almost not fair.
Yeah. And so actually when I went to college, I actually studied economics.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
Yeah. Okay. But I did a lot. Like I was part of the marching band. I started an entrepreneurship fraternity with a few people.
You were high energy.
Very much. I started.
You still are, right?
I still am. Yeah, a bit. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, studying abroad, which then opened up my culinary world even further.
Oh, wow.
Atlas VPN is offering podcast listeners 86% off their 2-year VPN subscription. That's less than $2 a month to make sure your family's personal data is securely protected on all their devices. On top of that, you can get an additional 6 free months of service when you purchase in time for the new year. Now you can utilize all that Atlas VPN has to offer, like their next-gen encryption, safe browse technology, and data breach monitoring. Keep you and your loved ones protected from cyber threats in 2024. Go to get.atlasvpn.com/moviemakingpod. That's getatlasvpn.com/moviemakingpod to get 86% off today.
So your first project, you get done with college and stuff. When did you do your first project?
You mean my first project out of college?
Yeah. And what was it?
Well, so it was Taste. I've been working on Taste for a very, very long time.
Oh, wow.
Nearly 10 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was born out of failure and rejection.
Lot of good things are.
That's true. That's very, very true.
Oh, so how many episodes have you made of Taste? Because it's getting ready to launch in a different way, isn't it? What's the status of it?
So I'm in post-production. I filmed 70 short films across 21 countries.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. It's been quite a wild ride. I filmed everything from like dictator fighting restaurateurs in Myanmar to Michelin starred chefs in Europe, cricket farmers in Thailand, snail farmers in Vienna, Jewish bakers who fight. Yeah.
So how did you come up with, okay, I'm going to do Taste. Did it just evolve, or you came up with the idea and then set out to do it?
No, it definitely evolved.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the writing process, you know, just try a bunch of stuff, see that half of it is junk, and then keep refining it. But basically, you know, as you've already heard, like I've always liked filming food and food documentaries.
Yeah.
But I'm specifically like, this is not a documentary series about food itself. It's about risk takers who make food from around the world. Some of the most undiscovered.
It's probably like a lot of human condition the messages about the human. Yeah, I guess condition, it might be the right word.
Yes, yes. And so, specifically about living an authentic life through food. So what I mean by that is, like I mentioned that I filmed like a snail farmer. So he used to be an IBM IT consultant.
Oh my God, that's cool. Wow. And he
resurrected the lost art of snail farming in Vienna. Surprisingly, Vienna escargots is the worldwide capital of escargots is not in Paris or France.
It's Vienna.
It's in Austria. It's in Vienna. And he brought that back from the dead.
That's interesting.
And he was just doing an IT consulting job before
that's crazy.
People calls him in German, verrückt, which means crazy. But he wanted to live this authentic.
It works for him. Yeah. How did you pick where to go?
Well, I mentioned that I studied abroad in Europe when I was in college. And I studied in Denmark, in Copenhagen, which was one of the culinary capitals of the world at the time. And it still is. In fact, I saved up eating cheese and crackers for months to go to Noma, which was one of the best restaurants in the world. And basically, as I was studying in Copenhagen, I would like flights from Copenhagen to different parts of Europe are pretty cheap.
Yeah.
So I would just go. And then I also got a Eurorail pass. And so I went to like a lot of Eastern Europe. I'm half Polish. So I went back to Poland there. Nearly.
Did you have to pre-contact people like to set it up, or you'd go there and then kind of figure out where you're going to end up filming?
Well, since I'm backpacking, it's kind of like just spur of the moment kind of thing. I mean, there were some friends that I knew in other places that I would like visit and stuff like that. And
yeah,
I would stay at hostels and Airbnb. Well, not Airbnb. Couchsurfing.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, it's couchsurfing.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I would do that.
That's cool. So was it just you and your camera, or did you go with someone else? Like, what was the process like on the filmmaking side?
Well, so me in Europe, studying abroad, I wasn't filming anything. It was more just like traveling.
Right.
But if you fast forward past my time, like after graduating from college, it was the tail end of the economic recession. Nobody was hiring. I was getting job rejection after rejection. And my buddy Brian, who helped found the Film and Photography Society at UCLA with me and a bunch of other people.
Oh, cool.
He gave me a call and he said, "Hey, we just got invited to a big film festival in Asia. Do you want to come?"
Oh.
And I was like, "I don't know, man.
How am I going to pay for it?"
Yeah. He was like, "Well, dude, what is your job? What do you actually want to do with your life?" And as we talked about before, I hadn't really
nailed that down.
Yeah. Like, I knew what I liked in life, but, you know, it's not like my parents, as I mentioned, are both optometrists.
Mm-hmm.
They like to say there's a motto in the optometry game: no pain, instant gain. They're very risk averse. They're very shy. Yeah. I love the bits. They're very supportive of me and what I do. But the idea of becoming a filmmaker was not exactly something that was instilled in me as a child. It was something that I was gravitating towards. But no one in my family was saying, like, you should do that as a job.
Yeah, it's risky. What's your fallback?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so hence part of the reason why I became an economics student. You know, I was in a, like the thing that broke the camel's back was I was interviewing for Google, which was like, you know, the creme de la creme postgraduate kind of thing or job, especially, you know, before a lot of like big tech went to shit in some ways. This was 10 years ago. So like Google and all these other places had a little bit better image and track record. But basically I had three rounds of very intense, almost consulting style interviews. And by the last one, I got rejected. And that's when my friend Brian gave me a call. And so I thought about it for a week. And then he says, and then I got back on the phone. I said, okay, I'll go with you, but on one condition. I want to take your camera and I want to film what I love.
I love that.
And so to answer your question, what's the setup? It's basically been me and a camera and sometimes a monopod. Of course, I have a few microphones and things like that, but it's a very small operation.
So it's kind of like authentic and personal and kind of like you and I talking here, and maybe you're following the chef around or, you know, the people that are your subjects.
Yes. Well, I will say I do an immense amount of research before I even film anything. Like I have a Skype conversation with them or a WhatsApp or what kind of like, and even before that conversation, I do immense online research. So I know their story inside out.
Before you get there. That's
before
awesome.
I get there. And so
can you record all that too?
The Skype conversations,
all the interviews and all. Yeah. Do you end up recording that or I'm just being nosy to your process?
Yeah, no. I'm happy to answer those questions because I think this would be very helpful for other filmmakers. I don't record the Skype conversations or the WhatsApp because I'm still kind of understanding whether it's a story that they would need to be told or worth going across the world to tell.
Right.
And so, and plus I wouldn't be able to do much with it because like if I was making a podcast, maybe, but with documentaries, it'd be kind of tough to interweave that.
Material.
I do very thorough research. And then once I get there, it's just me with my camera and a few microphones and stuff like that. But I already have a pretty good idea of what the story is I'm going to tell.
How long do you spend with them? Are you there a long time or you go for like a week? What's that side like?
It depends. It depends mostly upon their schedule, but also my travel schedule as well.
Right.
But it could be as little as a couple days to a week. Yeah. Okay. And these are short films. So like, the films end up being anywhere from like 4 minutes to 20 minutes. For example, that Snail Farmer episode, Verruckt, the Snail Farmer of Vienna, is only 4 minutes.
Okay.
I filmed that over 3 days.
Wow. Do you have more you want to do with this first round of Taste? Or do you have other projects you're kind of like looking forward to getting into at this point?
Well, I am working on a feature-length documentary that's kind of based upon my story that I just explained to you, like my personal story.
Oh, I love that.
You kind of think of it as like Richard Linklater's Boyhood meets
that's awesome.
a young guy who's trying to make a food documentary series. Because I'm in this unique position where I have footage ever since I was 8 years old.
Wow.
And kind of like learning and growing at like from this shock. That kid who was afraid to talk to girls to this, to what I'm doing now. An interesting journey. And
it's definitely really interesting. And you can share so much, even from like the control we have in our own lives from any point in getting healthy to actual, living your authentic life, because these people you're meeting, hopefully they have found where they belong in life and they are loving their journey like the snail farmer of all things, but it's kind of amazing. So I imagine you can share a lot of important, meaningful things in your documentary when you do that. That's very, very cool. So how would people find more about you and about Taste?
Well, we have a few sneak preview episodes out online. On Amazon Prime, there's a film called Dictionary of a Food Hero, which is one of the first films that I made for Taste. We've been in a little over 40 film festivals right now, but we are in post-production for a lot of the films. Like, this is a series and I want to consistently post these out.
Yeah.
So I want to finish editing the series and putting the time and attention that these stories deserve before putting them out. And so,
actually,
as I mentioned, I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, but actually moved last year to New York City to build out a team. For post-production, for editing. And then I'm also looking specifically for a business development partner to build out like the commercial end of our production.
Do you ever see it becoming possibly like a mainstream show? Because it would be extremely interesting.
First of all, thank you. We'll see. We will see. I mean,
never say never.
Yeah, never say never. Like, my end goal, if I had like this dream show to create, would be to meld the cinematic beauty of Planet Earth, BBC's Planet Earth.
Yes.
Ooh. Journalistic integrity and doggedness of, say, the New York Times, FX's The Weekly, or 60 Minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Blending those two and telling the most amazing stories of the people who make food from around the world.
Yeah. And those people surprised us, because I was reading some of the people that you've actually worked with, and it's surprising who is behind food. Some of these people you've met. So
yeah. I mean, I've filmed with people who have survived genocides. I've filmed with people who fight dictatorships with their food. And like, it's astounding. Well, I believe the reason why I do this, well, there's many reasons, but I believe that nothing unites us more than food and stories. And I believe that food is a window into every aspect of our lives. Food is, of course, as we discussed, health.
Right.
It's the environment, it's war, it's peace, it's family, it's feasts, it's the social justice. It's all these different things wrapped up into a this little package. And
that's
so
true. It is true.
I feel
they say the heart of any home is the kitchen. There's a reason for that, right? Like, you know, we gather in the kitchen. We come together. So.
Yeah. And especially considering that, you know, your children are mixed race Indian. And what's your background?
I'm a mutt, like Irish, Scottish, you know, I'm just a mutt. There's so many.
I'm sure your kitchen is pretty diverse as well.
I don't like to cook. I like to write. So if you need cooking to live, it might be rough. I mean, I found out there's some kind of rule book. You're supposed to feed your children. And so I did. No, I'm just kidding. No, well, I don't cook because I can't really see. I could burn the house down.
Fair point.
Yeah.
Well, at the very least, considering, you know, your journey with your health, you're probably cognizant of what you're feeding your...
I am now. So much so. And I think about it when my kids were little. This is a really good example because I didn't know better. My daughter, when she was young, I thought having, like, I can't think of the names, but you know, the sweet drinks that are like red fruit punch and they're filled with vitamin C. So when she was little, I'm afraid to say their names, right? But you know what I'm talking about? And they had vitamin C. So I thought, oh, I'm giving her something healthy.
Mm.
No. Mm-mm. By the time my son was born, who is my writing partner in what I do, but you know, all the labels started having all the information and you started realizing, oh my God. And then by the late 2000s, it was just painfully obvious that a lot of the stuff I fed them as kids, I shouldn't have been feeding them. Mm-hmm. But the way I was raised, you know, when my mom was pregnant, it was a 2-liter bottle of Pepsi every day kind of thing. So she didn't know that was bad, just like smoking in the 60s. They didn't know the 50s quite how bad it was yet. So, you know, live and learn.
To your point, it builds upon every single generation.
It does.
Knowledge of food. And also, I've noticed with food filmmaking and food television, you know, started with like Julia Child in a humble little kitchen. to then, you know, cooking shows, Martha Stewart, and then Anthony Bourdain. Who knows what's going to happen next? But I hope to be,
yeah,
contribute somehow to it.
You could be a part of that in some way, and I could see it. So it's very, very cool. And I've had so much fun talking to you, just because if I could, you know, be a bird in all the places you went. Before we move to our 5 for 5, what is one thing that you perhaps learned or were surprised to learn about the people around the world and food? I don't know if you can answer that. It's probably a big one, but
yeah, it's so diverse, depending upon where I've gone and food. But I think food and independence plays a huge role. So I mentioned a woman who I filmed who's fighting the dictatorship in Myanmar with.
Oh, wow.
One would think, how does that work? How do you fight a dictatorship with carrots or with, you know,
you feed the people that need to be there to fight it? I don't know.
Partially, yes.
Okay.
Also, though, you know, when you think about it, food is power, especially in a country like Myanmar, where,
like, controlling the water or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Where, you know, you can't eat money, right?
I can't.
I think most people don't have the digestive tract to digest quarters and nickels.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
And so basically she has her own farm in Inle Lake, a beautiful lake in Myanmar where, you know, it's famous for their fishermen who row with their legs and they have these conical necks to catch fish. But anyway, she's been able to carve out this like small little paradise where she has her own sustaining ecosystem. She can kind of like basically
live
off the grid.
Wow. Okay.
And so food as a way of, you know, having ownership and being resilient and being independent. I just see that through and through. Another one small example is I filmed a Jewish baker in Budapest who's fighting anti-Semitism that's rising in Hungary.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's basically, she makes this cake called the Flodny cake. It's a traditional Hungarian Jewish cake that helps peacefully, you know, help encourage the Jewish culture to the, you know, locals in Budapest. And anti-Semitism has become a huge issue, particularly
everywhere.
Hungary. Yeah. And everywhere. And so, yeah, that's very encouraging. And then I have one other thing. I truly mean it, that I came to New York to build out a team. And so you asked like where people can kind of like find me and connect with me. I do post out little teasers of the Taste series on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram and Facebook every day. But yeah, just hit me up on Instagram at Taste with Kevin. And yeah, specifically, I'm looking for a business partner to help build up the commercial side of Taste and also for editors.
And everywhere is pretty much Taste with Kevin, right?
Exactly.
Your branding. Oh, that's great. Okay. Taste with Kevin. Remember that.
Yes.
All right. Well, you have been awesome. And if you're ready, we're going to do the 5 for 5.
Let's do it.
So, okay. All right. Here's the first question, which is, I really wonder what you're going to answer for this one, but okay. Question one, what is your favorite food?
Thai food.
Thai food. Oh, like pad Thai or something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Curries specifically.
There's a lot of curry in my house. Yeah. Okay. That's cool. All right. What is non-filmmaking something that inspires you or motivates you in your life?
Exercise.
Oh, man, I wish I could say that. I'm trying so hard to get to that point, and I'm getting
it's
better.
It's been a while, too, so don't.
Yeah,
don't.
I'm just like, I've been good, though.
It took me a couple decades.
A year and a half. Oh, God, I need it faster. That's a great answer, though, because moving. Yeah, if I could come back, I'd probably be a dancer. Now I'm just in my head, you know, dancing.
Just walking is just
that's fun. Every day with my kid. That's what we do. So I love that. That's a great answer. So, okay, what is something you have always dreamed of doing but you haven't done yet? Not film related.
Oh, damn! I was about to say something.
Sorry, nothing film related. These are personal. Yeah.
Fall in love.
Get a puppy, dude. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, okay, yeah, that's a nice one. Yeah, okay. That's a nice one. I'm just kidding. So a little bit, maybe. No. Okay.
Travel has made that one hard.
Oh, well,
the career path.
Okay. You Yeah, you can't have a puppy either then, can you?
No, I can't.
Both would be a problem.
No, oh, but man. I've been settled here in New York for a while. That's some other
Okay, ladies, get to New York.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I'm just terrible. Kevin. Yeah, go find Kevin. He's in New York. Come on. Yeah. No. Oh, my God. That's awesome. All right. Number four, what is your favorite song to sing at the top of your lungs when you're driving in a car? Or a rickshaw or something.
Maybe something by Arcade Fire.
Okay, I don't know off the top of my head.
Wonderful band.
Can you sing one?
I don't know the lyrics by heart. Probably Power Out by Arcade Fire. I wish I knew the lyrics by heart.
That's cool. Yeah. Okay, because if you did, you would sing it, right?
Yes.
Really? Oh, that's cool. Yeah. You'll have to come back. Practice.
Not in the car. I would be biking to it. I always bike to Arcade Fire.
I love that. That is perfect. You truly are. You changed. Being 11 was good for you.
It was.
You might not be who you are now had you not gone through all that hardship.
100%.
Yeah, it's cool. All right. Last question. This one's usually hard for people, but what is your favorite movie? I don't have one.
Well, I don't have one either, but I will tell you one that was... Two that were very formative for me.
Okay.
Titanic was the one that made me want to become a filmmaker.
Oh, okay. That one's just about love.
It is, yes. well, what I liked, I mean...
It's good filmmaking, though. It really is.
What I appreciated about it, because I was like eight, and there's a whole story behind watching that film, but like...
You saw that at eight?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And I was more in it for the action. And I admittedly, actually, at first, I didn't even know what the movie was.
Oh, gotcha.
James Bond was coming out, and I was into James Bond. So my birthday falls near Thanksgiving every year.
Okay.
And so a lot of big movies come out. And so as a tradition, my family would go to the movies for my birthday.
That was our Black Friday. We've always done that my whole life. Go to a movie.
Exactly. Yeah. And James Bond, Tomorrow Never Dies was coming out that year. And I wanted to see that really, really badly. And then my parents were like, let's do a double feature. Let's see this movie about a boat. And I kind of rolled my eyes. And was like, that sounds so boring. A movie about a boat.
Yeah.
And of course,
funny.
James Cameron's epic. And what I love about his films and Titanic in particular is he's epic yet intimate.
Really was. So what's the other one? You had another one?
Once, which is very intimate. Once is a John Carney film. It's Glenn Hansard and Marketa Anglova. It was back in 2007, 2008, that movie came out.
I know the title. I don't think I've seen that one. I have seen Titanic, but...
Yeah, wow.
Oh, wow. It's a love story, right?
Kind of, but it's not... It's very almost platonic love. It's very music-centric, but it's not a conventional musical either.
Oh, I love that.
It won Best Song at the Oscars. And actually, the director, Jace, came out with a new movie called Flora and Son, which I am in love with.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, just it's a very like indie movie. Like it was made for only a few $1,000s, but...
Oh, I love that. I could do that. That's cool.
Like a polar opposite of Titanic in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool. You have been so awesome to talk to today. And I wish you great, great success with Taste. I think it's phenomenal what you're doing going around the world like that. So
thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes. Come back anytime if you want to just chat. And I will be watching for new things to come out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Movie Making with Renell Golden is brought to you by Samira Entertainment, supporting indie films and the filmmakers who create them. Stop by their website to learn more, www.samiraentertainment.com. That's www.samiraentertainment.com. You've been listening to Movie Making with Renell Golden. Be sure to come back for our next episode where we bring you the people who make movies you love. Got a topic about filmmaking you want to hear on our podcast? Send us an email at moviemakingpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.